You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, March 21st, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar, and this is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Welcome to the program, ladies and gentlemen. We've got quite a program for you today. We've got a new war to talk about. That'll be fun for a couple of days. Then we'll all just forget about it, and we'll have three wars. We'll have three wars that we're waging. On the program today, Heather Hulbert will be here from the National Security Network to discuss it. On Friday, we were just, I guess the UN Security Council had approved a no-fly zone plus that... actually involves just a bombing run. Tomahawk missiles we've fired now, 100 of them. War is costing us $100 million a day. And, I just got a report on the endgame. Oh, I'm just kidding. Have no idea how this ends. We will talk to Heather Hulbert. Maybe she has a notion. We will talk more about this as the show progresses. But we have other news to get to as well. Out of Japan, things were looking good. Well, of course, it goes back and forth. I mean, listen, the bottom line is nothing's looking good in Japan. Police now believe over 18,000 people have died. I would expect that number to go higher. And in the wake of what, in and of itself, is a massive, massive tragedy. I mean, you watch these videos coming out of people just driving in their car and then all of a sudden being swallowed up by water. It's just horrible. And the Japanese people still having to deal with this sword of Damocles hanging over their heads. These crippled nuclear reactors at the Fukushima Daiichi plant. This morning at 9:34 a.m., the AP reported that gray smoke rose from two different reactors on Monday, temporarily stalling critical work to reconnect power lines and restore cooling systems to stabilize these radiation-leaking nuclear complex. And in the meantime, you know, almost simultaneously or just before that, Reuters was reporting that two reactors number 2 and 3 had received power, which means that they can hook up their water pumps, which means that they can attempt to keep both the spent fuel reactor pools cooled and the reactors themselves cooled. Back to AP reporting that the process is proceeding in fits and starts. Quoting Governor Yuhei Seto of Fukushima Prefecture, I guess that's the state, our crisis is still going on, our crisis with the nuclear plants. We are doing everything we can to bring that to an end. He told the more than 1,000 people moved away from the plant into a gymnasium. Don't give up. We know you're suffering. 63-year-old truck driver was, please get us out of here. No one is quite sure what caused the smoke to billow, first from the Unit 3 at the Fukushima Daiichi plant and then later from Unit 2. They are still investigating this. Traces of radiation are tainting vegetables and some water supplies, although in the amounts the government and health experts say do not pose a risk to human health in the short term.
I don't think so.
One doesn't know. I mean, I've seen reports of people who say that they had family farms near Chernobyl, and they were fine. And then, of course, you also hear reports of people still suffering birth defects at this time. TEPCO has promised that it would compensate farmers affected by bans on the sale of raw milk, spinach, and canola. And the crisis has brought renewed security to TEPCO, a wealthy, politically influential utility that has been accused in the past of safety violations. That, from what I have read, is a complete understatement. Days before the disaster, a NYSA report criticized Tokyo Electric. NYSA, I believe, is the National Industrial Safety Agency in Japan, for failing to inspect crucial equipment related to cooling systems at the Fukushima plant. Though agencies, officials refused Monday to draw a link between the inspection lapses and the breakdown. Yes, I would imagine they would refuse to draw a link to that. And early on Monday, the health ministry advised Litate, a village of 6,000 people about 30 miles northwest of the plant, 19 miles northwest of the plant, not to drink tap water due to elevated levels of iodine. One of our listeners in Japan has emailed me. He is a freelance journalist and photographer that he will be moving north into the area of these plants and hopes to send us dispatches later in the week. Can't promise anything. Don't want to promise anything. Because in no way, I've made this very clear to him that, you know, we will run with anything that you send us. But please, I hope, you know, this isn't, you're not going as a function of any type of request on our part or any capacity on our part, because I just don't want that responsibility, frankly. It's dangerous up there, I think. But he assured me that he is going anyways. That was his plan, and he wants to make sure that he has at least a couple of outlets in which to present this stuff. And, yes, absolutely. Please be safe. Please be safe, and hopefully we'll be talking to him later in the week. This from Bloomberg last week. About the history of TEPCO. In 2002 and 2007, revelations of the utility had faked repair records, forced the resignation of the company's chairman and president, and a three-week shutdown of all 17 of its reactors. So you've got this company that has a history of misfeasance, malfeasance. Now, I'm not suggesting that what has taken place at Fukushima is directly a product of the fact that in the past that they have faked reports and have had design flaws, et cetera, et cetera. It may or may not be. I certainly am in no position to tell. A lot of people have questioned the placement of those spent fuel rods. My understanding is they're actually above the reactors. I'm not a nuclear physicist, but I am educated enough to know the concept of gravity. It doesn't seem like a good idea to me.
As far as I know, you got to keep it close enough so that when you swap them out, you can transport them still in water. But the idea is that you're supposed to take those fuel rods to a more permanent storage eventually, and that they hadn't done that.
Right. And then how do they get them from up above?
Right.
I don't know. Maybe it makes sense, maybe it doesn't. My understanding is they also had their diesel generators in the basement. And I am also, again, not a nuclear physicist, but As someone who understands that people's basements often flood because they are below the ground, that may not have necessarily been the best place to have all of them. Be that as it may, again, I'm in no position to judge these things. However, what is clear is that there are people in Japan who are in a position to have judged TEPCO's past. In an interview in 2007 after Tokyo Electric's Kashiwaki nuclear plant, I butchered that, of course, was struck by an earthquake, Ishibashi said fundamental improvements were needed in engineering standards for atomic power stations, without which Japan could suffer a catastrophic disaster. Ishibashi, a professor at Kobe University, says that Japan's history of nuclear accidents stemmed from an overconfidence in plant engineering. In 2006, he resigned from a government panel on reactor safety, saying the review process was rigged and unscientific. That almost sounds like every regulatory agency that deals with energy in this country. We didn't learn anything, Ishibashi said in a phone interview. A nuclear power is a national policy, and there's a real reluctance to scrutinize it. Questioning the placement of the diesel generators, Ken Brockman, a former director of the nuclear installation safety at the IAEA in Vienna, said, this in the country that invented the word tsunami, placing those backup diesel generators in the basement. Japan is going to have to look again at its regulatory process and whether it's intrusive enough. But, you know, as we've learned from the Ayn Rand devotees in this country, if a bunch of people get radiated and die, and half the country ends up being poisoned, then consumers can know that next time they choose a nuclear power plant, they should go with a different outfit that's making them. That's what's called being an informed consumer. I know that if I get my power from TEPCO and they're going to build a nuclear power plant in the future, because I'm an informed consumer, I know that I won't buy TEPCO products because they poisoned half my country and my children and my food and my air and myself. Lesson learned, the free market always works. In 1990, a report by the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, an independent agency responsible for safety at the country's power plants, identified earthquake-induced diesel generator failure and power outage as the leading to failure of cooling systems as one of the most likely causes of nuclear accidents from external event. This report was cited in a 2004 statement by Japan's Nuclear and Industrial Safety Agency. It seems adequate measures to address the risk were not taken by TEPCO, said Jun Tinto, a former researcher at the Japan Atomic Energy Agency and professor at Chuao University. I'm butchering all these names, but I think you get it. I'm not doing it on purpose. There was another scandal involving TEPCO. Mitsuhiko Tanaka, 67, working as an engineer at Babcock Hitachi, helped design and supervise the manufacture of a $250 million steel pressure vessel for Tokyo Electric in 1975. Today, that vessel holds the fuel rods in the core of the number 4 reactor at Fukushima's Daiichi plant. Tanaka, and I can say that because I think I heard that name once on a Bond movie, says the vessel was damaged in the production process. He says he knows because he orchestrated the cover-up. When he brought his accusations to the government more than a decade later, he was ignored, he says. The law required a flawed vessel to be scrapped, a loss that Tanaka said might have bankrupted the company. Rather than sacrifice years of work and risk the company's survival, Tanaka used computer modeling to devise a way to reshape the vessel so that no one would know it had been damaged. He did that with Hitachi's blessing, he said. I saved the company billions of yen, Tanaka said in an interview March 12th, the day after the earthquake. Tanaka says he got 3 million yen bonus from Hitachi, which I guess is 38 grand, and a plaque acknowledging his extraordinary effort in 1974. At the time, I felt like a hero. that changed with the Chernobyl. 2 years after the world's worst nuclear accident, Tanaka went to the Ministry of Economy, Trade, and Industry to report the cover-up he'd engineered more than a decade earlier. Itachi denied his accusation, and the government refused to investigate. Well, so there you have it, folks. Remember, free market always works. Government intervention slows economic development. And you consumers are now better educated. You now have a better sense of making your choice. Next time, don't choose TEPCO, Japan. Lesson learned. Let's just move on to the next question. You know, what's the best synthetic made food to eat now that you can't grow your own because it's all been the soil's all been radiated? Or what wig are you going to shop for? We're going to take a break. We'll be back in a moment with Heather Hurlburt to talk about our new war. Christmas came early this year. Thank you, Father Christmas. Wonderful. I'm feeling a little caustic this morning. Anybody picking up on that?
A little bit.
All right, we'll be back in a minute. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Heather Hurlburt. She is the executive director of the National Security Network. You can check it out at nsnetwork.org. Heather, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Sam. It's great to be with you.
Now, Heather, let me ask you, obviously we have begun our no-fly zone plus under the auspices of the UN, which involves Tomahawk missiles, sending, allied jets bombing different parts of Libya. Let me ask you, is this, characterize this for me. I mean, are we involved in a true test of what the UN is supposed to be about? Are we on the road to a quagmire? Is it both of those things?
Yeah, I think it's exactly, or there's a strong risk of it being both of those things. Because this is what the UN is supposed to be able to do, is to step in and mobilize the world to step in when innocent lives are at risk, when there's a situation that it's not right for any one country to handle alone, when there's something that needs to be more about protecting innocent lives than about one country versus another, one leader versus another. And so that's the positive side of what's happening here, and it's worth saying that it does look as if, I mean, I'm clicking refresh on Al Jazeera just as often as you are, but it does look as if the advance toward Benghazi in the east has been stopped, that what looked like a humanitarian catastrophe in the making has been averted. So from that very narrow point of view, that what the UN is about is making it possible to use countries' military forces to save lives, it looks like that tactically is working. Now, at the same time, you have different countries, different leaders from different countries going out and saying different things about what is the final goal. That's obviously frightening. Libya is a big country. Gaddafi can run and hide there for a long time. It's very hard to drive someone from power with air power alone. What is the final end game? How are we going to get there? If Gaddafi's not interested in a negotiated outcome, there is a very serious risk of quagmire. There's also some very serious questions about how these decisions get made in the U.S. context. What should the role of Congress be? What is our long-term role going forward? And those are all legitimate and real questions.
Okay, so let's back up first with the first premise. How, I mean, in terms of characterizing this as saving civilians, how where is the line between this is a civil war, this is a an attempted sort of mass slaughter? How do we draw the line between something that is preemptive and or prohibitive in some way? I mean, you know, are preemptive or sort of like, I guess, actually stopping something that's ongoing? I mean, where how do we draw those lines? I mean, how I presume it's pretty vague.
I mean, the answer is we draw it in practice. If folks remember, we had this same debate over Kosovo. Was it okay? Was it okay in the case of Kosovo to go in militarily when killing hadn't started yet but seemed to be imminent? In this case, you have a leader saying, I'm going to show no mercy. You know, my troops are headed for Benghazi, and I'm going to show no mercy to my own citizens. To me, that's pretty clearly across the line.
Okay, I mean, fair enough. And so you've got Gaddafi who's claiming this. And then where does, and I guess at that point, the UN resolution says it on its face, take any steps necessary. So that doesn't necessarily mean you can't fly. It means if you got to send Tomahawk missiles, that's what you do.
Yeah.
And so when we get a reaction from the Arab League now, who, I mean, was this simply a bait and switch type of situation with them? I mean, they were calling for this no-fly zone, presumably to save civilians. They must have known as well as anybody that a no-fly zone in and of itself, just saying we're grounding your jets, Gaddafi, wouldn't be enough. But yet now they've come out and they now seem to oppose what's going on.
So my interpretation of that is that the Arab League leaders are trying to walk a political tightrope just like everybody else, and they're in a position that they have not been in ever before, where suddenly the mood and reaction of their citizens matters tremendously in a way that it didn't just 6 or 8 months ago. So, you know, maybe the Arab League leaders all understood, as the American military has been trying to tell us, that a no-fly zone doesn't just mean you announce there's a no-fly zone. It means you take out anti-aircraft missiles. It means you take out advancing tank columns. But I think it's fair that they may well find that their citizenry didn't know that. And so they're now trying to balance their position in terms of making it clear to their own populations that they didn't sign up for pictures of cruise missiles slamming into Gaddafi's tent. But it looks to me like you had some critical statements, but you haven't had sort of the move to say, okay, let's go back to the UN and rescind this thing. So I think they're trying to walk a political tightrope of understanding that this needs to be done and also having the new and somewhat unfamiliar circumstance. You know, remember, Amr Moussa's running for president of Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
So he's trying to balance his domestic constituency and his international constituency at the same time. And he probably, again, because nobody in Egypt, it hasn't mattered what people thought for so long that nobody's quite sure, you know, they're all learning this as they go.
Right. I imagine there's not, I mean, you could take polls, but people probably aren't even used to answering polls in a way that they feel that they won't be paid, you know, that they could actually do so freely in some respects.
Yeah. And, well, you know, Sam, there's just one other thing, I mean, that I want to say about that, which is that it sounds very uncomfortable to come out of my mouth to say people are making this up as we go where human lives are concerned.
Mm-hmm.
But that's kind of the great tragedy of all of this is that, you know, we're so weak. When a leader decides that he wants to hurt his own people, we're so weak in instruments to come back on that. And all the instruments we have are flawed, and all of them are compromised, and all of them are tainted with all the bad things that have been done before, and all the failures of American foreign policy in the past, and all the failures of Arab foreign policy in the past, and all the failures of French foreign policy in the past. And so everything that happens is imperfect and compromised. And the question you have to wake up and ask yourself every day as a policymaker and as a citizen is, you know, have we saved more lives today than we spent today? Have we saved more lives today than we've cost in the future? And that's ugly, and it's not romantic, and it's not beautiful, But that's sort of the reality of this kind of policymaking.
And let me ask you this. I mean, I don't want to be too jaded about this, but do you think that the calculation would be the same or even remotely the same if Libya had no oil?
You know, it would be a really different calculation because the oil thing is playing both ways here. So you had the markets, for example, the markets hate this. The markets want just everything to be totally uninterrupted. So the markets are saying, you know, don't do anything. Just let him alone as long as he'll keep selling us the oil. And then you have the Italians and the French who buy a lot of Gaddafi's natural gas. The Italians in particular are very dependent on it, much more so than the U.S. is, by the way, who are just saying, okay, let's get this over with so that we can go back to having an uninterrupted natural gas flow. So, you know, I really think it cuts both ways in this mm-hmm. in this case.
I see. Okay, and fair enough. I mean, I think that's true, and I think, you know, to a certain extent, we've seen at least American policy, it seems, sort of cutting both ways at different times as well. So let's move to the other part of this equation. Because even if we accept that without this intervention, and we should add that it is sanctioned by the UN in a way that Iraq, for instance, never was.
Iraq never was. Kosovo never was. Yeah, this is quite unprecedented.
It is unprecedented, isn't it? I mean, there has never been a situation quite like this where the UN has been this has worked in the way that it was theoretically supposed to.
That the regional organization came and said, we need help, and this is the help that we need.
And so then let's move to the other problem. What now? I mean, let's say just scenario one, Gaddafi stops. He's not going to attack Benghazi. Then what?
Yeah. So you got a bunch of scenarios here, and none of them, frankly, is very lovely. And so you have to remind yourself that the goal was to prevent the killing of thousands of civilians, and that the goal, there was nobody promised that Libya was going to look like Egypt or Morocco or Luxembourg. So you have one, Gaddafi asks for and receives a ceasefire and continues to be in charge, and there's some kind of chaos, there's some kind of limited ground fighting. Scenario number two is there's an actual kind of split partition of the country, and rebel forces who we don't understand who they are. There seem to be some very sympathetic elements, this Libyan National Council, the exile group that's sort of taken up residence at the State Department in Washington. There's no question there are some very unsavory people among the fighters, Islamist groups that, you know, all things considered, we would prefer not have control over territory. So that's the second scenario. A third scenario, I think, is that somehow at some point a coalition of groups either is able to fight back and fight their way to Tripoli, or that there's groups within Tripoli that decide it would be convenient for them, for Gaddafi to get off the scene, and there's some kind of negotiated outcome among groups within Libya. But any of those solutions is going to take time and be messy, and as I said, is only preferable if you think that the alternative was a wholesale massacre of civilians.
And did I misread this or mishear it? But I thought that Secretary of State Clinton said at her press conference the other day that they would welcome a negotiation, and at the end of it, they would like Gaddafi to leave.
No, I saw that too.
Okay, so I mean, isn't that? I mean, I haven't seen. I mean, to me, that seems like an explicit agenda of regime change here. That would go beyond.
Remember, Obama said two weeks ago that Gaddafi must go. So it's, you know, when I respect Admiral Mullen for going on television and saying this is humanitarian, it's not about Gaddafi, because that's what the UN resolution says. But nobody, I don't think it's very credible to imagine that the U.S. doesn't have a goal of regime change here. But I think here, you know, one way of understanding what might unfold next is, again, to think back to Kosovo, where it was quite clear to everybody that the U.S., including Milosevic, that the U.S. wanted Milosevic gone, but it took almost another year after the conclusion of military hostilities before Milosevic was finally removed by democratic means within his own society, and somehow everybody lived with that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we have one of those scenarios where we want Gaddafi to go, but that's not what this military intervention is about in the short run.
Yeah, it's all very easy for us to sit on the outside and say, oh, this is inconsistent and it looks really messy and sloppy and horrible. But especially for those of us who think that the U.S. should be very, very modest about when it decides that it's a good idea to decide who should be the ruler of another country, you know, this is the U.N., this is the regional governments putting some legitimate brakes on what it is that, you know, people in Washington want. And I mean, I would like to see Gaddafi gone too, but I also think that U.S. military power may not be the right way to achieve that.
And so what should America policy be at this point going forward to make sure that, A, we don't have undue influence on what the outcome is this? I mean, because it seems to me that if we're going to maintain the legitimacy, if we are going to look at this as an unprecedented moment where the U.N., in some ways, has functioned the way that us utopians have always dreamed it would. What does the U.S. need to do at this point to make sure that they don't go beyond that mandate, as at least in terms of the U.S.? I mean, obviously, you know, we have some influence on what the British do and the French do and the Italians, but I imagine it's somewhat limited beyond their own self-interest. What should we be doing, and what kind of markers can be put up there so that it's clear that we have at least an exit strategy for American involvement and a means in which to communicate to the rest of the world that this really is about this limited mandate of protecting civilians?
Yeah. So, you know, you can understand why they didn't do this initially, because, of course, everybody was hoping that Gaddafi would fold like a house of cards, and you didn't want to foreclose that immediately. But what should be happening now, and what I hope is happening and assume is happening behind the scenes now, is that the countries involved are getting ready to make some statements later in the week. I know they're going to convene the UN Security Council again to discuss, and that what will come out of that is some indications of this is what we see as acceptable. This is the standard of protection that we expect for Libyan civilians. This is what will lead us to stop the action, and then Gaddafi can sort of figure things out for himself within that context, and that those statements would be things that the Arab League governments and the other UN Security Council members could also sign on to. Now, Sam, when that happens and it's released, it's going to get criticized here. It's going to be weak. It's going to be, oh, Obama's not leading. Oh, Obama's leading this despot in power. So the thing to recognize is that the U.S., by trying to do the right thing here, is really sort of in a circumstance where we can't win. But for all the reasons that you just laid out, you know, having some clarity about what's going to be enough in the near term is important, and also going to the Brits and the French and saying, hey, we need to transition this to a phase where, you know, the cruise missiles don't have American flags on them. And frankly, it's going to be in the British and the French interest to dial down the military piece of it as well. So that's what I hope is happening.
Okay, and just one final question. I've seen a lot of sort of mixed reports that somehow the U.S. was mandated to do this because of the U.N. charter, that in some way that if the U.N. asked the U.S. to provide military hardware in this situation, that they must. Is that the case?
That's a grossly misleading way to put it, actually. Nobody should hide behind that, because you have to remember, I mean, who's the UN in this case? It's the Security Council governments, which is us, right? We have a veto, so we can prevent the UN from asking us anything we don't want the UN to ask us. And people who make that argument, you get kind of into this, you know, this kind of set of bogus, scary world government talking points. And the fact is, NATO is set up in such a way that some of these capabilities only the U.S. has. So when you decide to use NATO to do a military operation, there are just certain things that, if they're going to get done, the U.S. is going to do them. And we, with our allies, decided that this is how this operation would work. Right. We negotiated it with the U.N., and so now we're doing it. But, you know, let's not pretend that there's some kind of, you know, black helicopter power that's compelling the U.S. to do this. We did this because our government chose to do it.
And I'm sorry, one more question. In terms of Congress's role here, shouldn't the president at this point, or even before this, have had some consultation with congressional leaders? I mean, doesn't Congress have a role here? I know the War Powers Act says 60 days and whatnot, and I know that we've already signed off on the UN Charter, but it seems to me that we could be entering again another couple of years here.
So there's two things. One is there do seem to have been quite a few rounds of consultation with Congress of various officials going up and briefing various people and calling various people. So saying there was no consultation is not true.
Okay.
But that's different, as you note, from the War Powers Act. And this continues a pattern that has gone on for years and years now, that administrations of both parties just basically ignore the provisions of the War Powers Act.
Fantastic. Well, that's always cheery. What are you going to do? Heather Hurlburt, thank you so much for at least for, you know, bringing some clarity at least to the issues that are involved here. And hopefully we can speak to you again soon to get an update, not to mention what is going on in Yemen, in Bahrain, and in Syria, all these places that who knows, maybe we'll – I mean, maybe we just move the whole country there. We wouldn't even have to deal with even just sending our military there. We could just take over the whole area. I won't even make you comment on that.
I can't wait for that conversation, Sam. Thanks for having
Heather,
me.
Thanks for joining us.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Heather Hurlburt at the National Security Network. And so there you have it. I mean, I guess it depends on where you fall on that divide as to whether or not you took Gaddafi seriously, that he was going to slaughter these people in Benghazi, and whether you think that was the only way to stop that was going to be military intervention. I don't know where I land on that. I do feel to a certain extent that that is the proper role for the UN, is to stop something like that. I get a little bit hazy when we start getting into sort of stopping something that's ongoing and preemption, because preemption, obviously, that's what we heard in that's the war that we waged in Iraq. Wasn't it preemptive? What was it? I can't even remember now. Prohibitive, I think it was, but I mean, they claimed it was preemptive. Of course, what was it preempting? So I don't know. I will take your comments on that in the IM section, I am sure. This would be a great time to take phone calls, but we don't have a phone yet. We will soon, and believe me, every membership that we get takes us one step closer. Meanwhile, I had mentioned that Libya is obviously not the only place this the revolution is in the air, at least in the Middle East, and we see this even in Syria. Protesters set fire to the ruling Ba'ath Party headquarters and other government buildings in the southern city of Dara on Sunday, as protesters rallied and clashed with police for a third straight day. This is in Syria, of all places. And, you know, in places like Syria, they quash this like 15 minutes after it starts. So the fact that this is actually escalating is noteworthy and scary, because who knows how Assad will clamp down on this. Police officers fired live ammunition into the crowds, killing at least one and wounding scores of others, witnesses said. Assad also made supposedly some conciliatory gestures in an apparent attempt to stop the cycle of public anger that has fueled uprisings across the Arab world. Thousands gathered in and around the Omari Mosque in Dara, chanting their demands, the release of all political prisoners, trials for those who shot and killed protesters, the abolition of Syria's 48-year emergency law, more freedoms, an end to pervasive corruption. No fear after today, the crowd chanted. That's according to witnesses and human rights activists. Amazing, just amazing. In Yemen, the rival tanks deployed to the streets in Yemen's capital Monday after three senior army commanders defected to the movement that is calling for the ouster of the present president, the U.S.-backed president in Yemen, leaving him with virtually no support among the country's most powerful institutions. This is a good sign it's over in Yemen for this guy. A Major General Ali Moshin al-Amar, commander of the army's powerful 1st Armored Division, was the most senior of the three commanders to join the opposition. The interesting thing is this guy, Al-Ammar, and the other two are actually from the same tribe as the President Saleh. I guess it's the Hashid tribe. And so this guy's lost his support even amongst his own tribe, or at least is his support is being undercut there. Remember, there were WikiLeaks cables that came out showing that Saleh had allowed the U.S. to use our drones to fly over and kill people. Apparently, Al-Qaeda operatives, supposedly. But he did this without informing his country. In fact, telling his country people that, no, I didn't allow it. Senior opposition leader said that contacts were underway with the president over a peaceful way out of the ongoing crisis. One option under discussion, he said, was for Saleh to step down and a military council to take over for him to run the country till presidential and legislative elections are held. Saleh, meanwhile, sent his some top ministers to Saudi Arabia. My guess is, how much money will you give me to leave peacefully? I don't need much. Whatever fits in this suitcase. That would be my guess. And so look to, people are already talking about this Major General Ali Moshen Al-Ammar as a potential candidate for president coming from that same tribe. So this is ongoing, obviously. Don't have that much more for you. Just a reminder, though. I am an extremely old person. I actually remember all the way during the time where everybody was talking about the Iraq War. And you'll remember at that time how proud the right wing was in this country that George Bush was able to use my hard work and get Mama McCarthy in to be our ally in this war on terror. I got going. He's now a reformed, not terror guy. So much so that Time, in May of 06, this is coming via Blue Texan over at Fire Dog Lake, ran the headline, "Why Gaddafi's Now a Good Guy?" And it was coming out of the Bush administration. They had talked about turning Gaddafi. And back in 08, Fox covered Condi Rice's trip to Libya. Quote, "The relationship has been moving in a good direction for a number of years now, and I think tonight does mark a new phase," said Condi Rice. Fox also reported they exchanged pleasantries, with Rice offering Gaddafi's greetings from President Bush. "Hey, Gaddafi, give it up. Is it a Q or a G or a K or what? Tell me. So I'm going to win Trivial Pursuit. It's my ace in the hole." So I guess that right-wing neocon project didn't work, and we're back to the old school. Let's just take this mofo out when it came to Gaddafi. I do think that there is something to be said about this being a precedent-setting action by the UN. If I wasn't in such a jaded mood today, I would say that this is good because it's setting, not only is it precedent, it is precedent-setting in that it is saying it enhances the effectiveness of the UN. It is an implicit, if not explicit, acknowledgement by the U.S. government that we need the U.N. to go in situations like this. Remember, the Bush administration ran roughshod over the U.N. in going into Iraq. Now, with that said, I am feeling a little jaded today. And frankly, if you believe that this policy, that this moment of going into Libya under the auspices of the UN at this time is somehow going to be a constraint upon future leaders to not go in a situation like this without the UN? Well,
I don't think so.
So that is that. I also want to say, I know we're running a little late here, but yesterday, hundreds of people rallied outside of Quantico on behalf and against the treatment of Army PFC Bradley Manning. He is the allegedly the person who leaked the cables and the video over the past that we've seen over the past year and a half to WikiLeaks. 35 people were arrested by police. The police were in riot gear. These people refused to vacate an intersection in front of the entrance to the Marine Corps base, Quantico. Amongst that 35 was, I believe, I'm not sure about this, and I don't even know if he'll be on his show tonight, but Mike Malloy, I believe, was one of those people. Wow. He had told me that he was headed down there and that he was prepared to get arrested if necessary, and he very well may be. Daniel Ellsberg, also arrested. He, of course, was the whistleblower, the leaker of the Pentagon Papers back in 1971? 70? 71? It doesn't matter. That's ancient history. It's back around the time the Bible was written. Apparently, there was very little violence, although there were short scuffles as some of the officers attempted to push the protesters. They sat beneath a yellow banner that read, "Caution, whistleblower, torture zone." Supposedly, prosecutors have told Manning's attorneys that they will not recommend the death penalty, though he is charged with almost two dozen charges, including aiding the enemy, which would be punishable by the death penalty. Okay, understand why they are stripping him naked and treating him this way. Putting him in isolation, trying to break him down, trying to destroy him, torturing him. Understand why they're doing it. They've given up the ghost on trying to get Julian Assange. They cannot, they can break him down, but he probably doesn't even know how to implicate Assange at this point. They are doing this to send a message that you do not... that if you in any way mess with the U.S. government, you will be tortured. You will face the death penalty. Which is an explicit, I think, admission that our justice system is not enough of a deterrent as far as they're concerned. And so we will take extra judicial steps to punish you if you do this. You know what what they really should do is they should put his whole family in Quantico and maybe any of his distant relatives and maybe anybody who's friends with him. This guy David House, who's his one friend that's allowed to visit him. They should put him in Quantico too. Maybe they should take the town. Find out where Manning, what town did Manning come from? They should take the entire town or village that Manning is from, and they should put them all in Quantico, because my understanding is that type of group punishment is also very effective. And
I don't know, man. Crescent, Oklahoma, only has about 1,200 people.
That's perfect. That's perfect. You could probably take that entire town, put them all in the base, make them all strip naked every night, and then line up in the base. And they should televise this. And that, I think, would send the best signal that, because look, there's 2.5 million people who have access to the information that Manning has. 2.5 million people who have access to that, apparently. I saw some number of that effect. Maybe it's less. I don't know. Maybe it's 200,000. Doesn't matter. all those people need to get a message, and I think really the best way to do that would be to take his whole town, From where? Oklahoma? Wherever it is?
Yeah, Crescent, Oklahoma.
Crescent, Oklahoma. It's not gonna be like anybody's going to miss that town. Take all those 1,200 people, put them all in Quantico, make them all strip naked, and show we will not tolerate this. That's the only thing that can be done, I think. That's the best way to do it. And then everybody will get the message. Got more stories, but I've run out of time, folks. So maybe we'll talk some about them in the post show, where I will take your IMs at Majority FM. Dorsey?
I was just going to say in the post show, I'll let everybody know how the conflict in Libya might affect the Majority Report directly.
Ooh. I'm going to stick around for that. I am intrigued. I am so intrigued. Look at that, Dorsey. Dorsey's like on the countdown. Like, how many days left do you have on this program?
Oh, as long as you need me, dude.
Seriously?
Well, April 4th.
See what Dorsey's doing, folks? Guy gets a significantly better job offer, and then all of a sudden he starts turning on the juice. Coming up with teasers for the post show.
This is what I'm doing all the time. I think that I'm not working.
That's right. See that? It's the lack of appreciation. That's how it comes. All right, folks. We got to take a break. We'll be right back for the flip side. The members-only section of our show, unless you're listening live, in which case it's everyone's section. You can IM me at Majority FM or any of the IMs that you may have had from the very, very, very past. Oh, also want to thank Scouroboros. He knows who he is. I'm just not saying his name right. He sent me some great stuff on this Minnesota Roller Girls. Cool mugs. Sent Milo a little pendant and cookies, which I have insisted must be taken out of the office immediately. They're delicious. All right, folks. See you on the other side. You hear that, folks? That's the sound of silence. Now, I don't want to get too philosophical on you here, but that's the sound you're going to hear if I can't get more members. And who am I going to get to join the Majority Report if not you? People who listen to the show on a daily, maybe thrice weekly basis. Become a member today, support the show, ensure its existence. And on top of that, you're going to get an extra 50 minutes of programming on a daily basis, access to members-only content on Majority.fm, and a warm, fuzzy feeling inside of you. Or that also could be some of the swag that I send. Either way, become a member today. And don't forget, we're sponsored by Just Coffee at justcoffee.coop. You can get tea, you can get chocolate, you can get coffee, obviously. It's all fair trade, it's delicious, and you can get 10% off by putting Majority in the coupon code at justcoffee.coop. So support the show! And enjoy it.